supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
What does it take to become the superintendent of a large city school district? Well, we invited Dr. William Height, superintendent of Philadelphia School District, to our studio to get the story behind the title. I'm Jamie Jay of First Person Arts with Elizabeth Perez Luna, and this is Common Space. At first glance, Height, who grew up in Richmond, Virginia, seemed an unlikely candidate to run one of the country's largest districts. But isn't it often like that with big achievers?
I think that I could have been a much better high school student and exerted a lot more energy around high school. But by then, I was playing sports, very involved, one of the big people on campus, and I didn't challenge myself as much as I should have, and just spent a lot of time focused on other things until it was really important to focus on all of the academic requirements in order to get into college on the athletic scholarship that I had. But I was an okay student, and through my time in elementary school and then in middle school, I remember I was an obedient student. In a small city like Richmond, I took advantage of that. My parents took advantage of it, and school was important to them. And when they were in high school, there were only two schools in Richmond, Virginia, that blacks could attend. One was Armstrong and one was Maggie Walker. And many didn't finish school. So it was really important to my mother and father that the four of us, my two sisters and brother, all finish high school. But it was a lot more fun because there were a lot of activities. You could learn to swim. You could learn other things that we didn't have access to in our schools. And so that was really important to me.
So what were the schools, you know, they talk about desegregation, right? Were the schools still divided a little bit like that when it was your turn to go to school? I mean, was there still a...
Yeah, our schools were still pretty much segregated. They were all black schools. And when I was growing up and going through school, this must have been in the late 60s, early 70s, they were still all black schools. And it wasn't until I was a junior in high school and we moved out of the city to the county that I attended school with whites or someone who was non-black. And it wasn't until I was a junior in high school did I have that experience. And in the city of Richmond at the time, it was mostly all black.
Was it a little bit of a culture shock?
It was a big culture shock, and it was a very different culture for me. Although we had relatives who lived out in the county system, and through the Boys Club, I came into contact with white children, Latino children, but it was a culture shock from the perspective of school. But by that time, I was a high school student, so I would imagine it would have been a much larger culture shock if I had been there, like in middle school or something like that. But it was a big difference for me and my oldest sister.
Were your parents aware of that you had to negotiate this big change?
They were aware, but what helped me more so than my sister, I would imagine, was football. Football at the county system was the same as the city system, but the team I came from the city was undefeated for multiple years. The team I'd gone to in the county system, they hadn't won a game. And so that was a big change. But nonetheless, it was exposure. And it was exposure that probably was beneficial to me as I then matriculated into college.
Was there a moment that you can recall when you decided to become an educator?
Yeah, I mean, it was out of college. And it was, I almost remember it distinctly. I was working at the time for an airline at Richmond International Airport, and it was Air Virginia, and they later became American Eagle. And I was working there as like this guy in marketing that was selling to travel agents the service. But then when you weren't doing that, you were doing the working the gate. Then when you weren't working the gate, you were working the field where the planes came in and out. And
wow.
So you did kind of everything. And I was doing that. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do this for a while, see how it goes. It was still physical. I was just out of sports. So that was helpful. A couple of days a week, I had to throw a tie on. And I remember getting this call from one of my college instructors who said that this high school that his daughter attended needed a substitute teacher. And in order to substitute, I should go over and talk to the principal because they also needed a coach, and he thought about me. And so then I went over, I started teaching, and I taught a class of 26 girls fashion merchandising, marketing, and economics. And those are the three classes I taught at this highly affluent school. And I so enjoyed it that it led to me going to a different school where I started coaching girls softball, football, and wrestling. And that was all still part-time. And because I was still doing my day thing, then I agreed to sub full-time. That led to teaching.
Okay, Dr. Height, if you thought I was going to let this pass, you're wrong. What did you know about fashion merchandising?
Nothing. I knew nothing about it. It was a substitute. I was a substitute in the class. And so, but I so enjoyed the students that I was working with. And somehow I got into marketing education. Part of that program was fashion. And it was putting colors together and textiles and outfits and fashion shows, and I didn't particularly care too much for that part, but it was more the interaction with the young people in the classroom. And I remember talking to all my friends because I was fresh out of college, and we would be out, and they would see some of the students in my class, and they would look at me like, "You have the best job in the world. How did you get that?" And it was that was a learning experience for me. And those young ladies taught me as much about fashion as I could ever teach them, and taught me as much about the importance of navigating through that time in their life than I could teach them. And all of those experiences then helped me as I work through the ranks of teacher, principal, central office staff to superintendent.
You know, what is it that you enjoyed? What is that satisfaction? What is that thing that teachers have, other people don't?
I would say passion and compassion are the things that make those individuals committed above all else and to continue to come back and to do the work under extraordinary circumstances. It is very impressive. But for me, it was particularly as I thought about reading and I thought about the young people who looked very much like I did growing up, who are unable to read, and then they learn that word. And it's even smaller than that. They could learn that sound, and they could see a B and ba, ba, ba. And then it forms a word from that sound. But that is an example of a young person figuring out a math problem, a young person putting together a robot, a young person finally understanding the periodic table or some formula approach, a young person who now understands how to solve a problem or is thinking about something very differently or has just written something that they are proud of. And they're trying to direct the actions and the skills and the abilities to that experience. And then when they experience it, it brings them back. If you're an educator and you haven't been excited about, then it's probably not the right feel for you. That's what brings individuals back. That's why so many individuals across the country do this. Lord knows we don't pay them enough. We don't here in Philadelphia. We don't anywhere. My daughter's a teacher. She doesn't make enough. And my sister is now a principal. She doesn't make enough. But it's why they keep coming back. And they keep coming back because these individuals are passionate about improving a child's ability to do something. They do it with compassion, which means I'm here and I'm going to be your support and I'm going to be your push. I'm going to see to it that you accomplish this, just as Ms. Boatwright did for me.
You know, I think inevitably everyone has a moment in their career life, in their professional life, where they think about giving it up. They just feel like, I can't do this anymore.
You have those moments all the time. Yeah. I mean, it is, and they come more than people think, right? So I remember my first week on the job as principal of a middle school. I had no idea how to be principal. I knew what I saw principals do. And I remember walking around the school literally almost in tears because it just didn't feel that I was right for that work. And we went on to do significant work there. And part of it was because of teachers who were there who said, young man, we're going to help you. But I remember that was my first experience with, I can't do this. As a teacher, I left for a year. And after I finished student teaching, I swore to myself I would never teach because the experience was so challenging. But we all become better educators the longer we do this. And I've had those moments as a superintendent. You know, there are times here in Philly when, you know, somebody else has to do this. I can't. This is just too tough. The circumstances are impossible. It's just not a place that will allow anyone to make the type of progress we need to see here. And then you have an experience, or then you talk to a child, or then you visit a school, or then you see a teacher who's done something magnificent. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, snap to it. You have to stay here in order to make this better for the young person or to try to improve conditions for educators.
I remember I used to teach in Philadelphia schools as part of work with a not-for-profit. So I wasn't a licensed certified teacher. I just went in to conduct workshops. After a while, I kind of got into the groove of teaching the kids. And there was a young man in the room. He never said much. And I would always have the kids writing. And he turned something in, and I took it home. And he was writing about the darkness in his soul. He was writing about the environment he was living in, which was terrible. And the next time I came into the class, he was there. And I said to him, you know, I think you did a great job with writing this. Would you like to talk about it? Would you be willing to read it for the class, or can I get you to talk to somebody? And he said no, and he never came back to class again. And that for me was a kid that we lost. How do you live with that?
Unfortunately, we have to all the time. I mean, and it is, particularly with some of our schools in the city, and we see there's a lot of transience, and so you see a level of mobility from one school. So you could have children that change each grading period. So that's one point. But the other point is this. There are also a lot of things that we as educators can do to keep the ones we have. And it is making sure that we construct the types of environments, that we provide comfort, that we show love and respect, and that we are empathetic to what they're dealing with. And it requires, and teaching today is much harder than it was when Ms. Boatwright and Ms. Proctor, my fifth and third grade teachers respectively, were doing this years ago. It's much harder today because children are exposed to a level of trauma that I wasn't exposed to as a child, and teachers are on the front line of that every single day. And it's one thing to get the children to learn to read, but you have to almost get them into the right frame of mind in order to do that, which is you have to address sometimes the traumatic experience that the young person has had before you can even get them to sit still in a classroom.
I would agree.
That is, and if we take that part for granted, then we're working against ourselves. It's requiring a whole different set of skills for educators these days, and they're not being equipped to do those types of things. So we have to think about things like the mayor's initiative around community schools to get other services into schools. And it's not just getting other services, but it's integrating and aligning those services in a way that's responsive to what that child needs.
Well, you know, you talk about the trauma. You mentioned that you were in school in the 60s and the 70s. Okay, you want to talk about a traumatic time in American history. You know, you went to school in a very difficult time in the South, but there were external social supports and systems in place, from the music that we were listening to that said, keep your head to the sky, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud, you know, to the church, to, you know, following Martin Luther King or even, you know, Malcolm X. There were these systems in place to support us and give us an outlet, you know, and they're not as organized today, you know, and a lot of the trauma is subversive and, you know, not overt.
And minus that system, we had neighbors.
Right.
And coaches and mentors, or the people who was working at the recreation center. I mean, all of those individuals were engaged in the success of young people. And I'm not suggesting we've lost that, although we have, but I'm suggesting that we have to return to this being everybody's problem to solve, not just educators' problem mm-hmm. to solve. And I think that's so critically mm-hmm. important.
What was that support system that you mentioned?
I had other teachers that were the support system. I had not so much my principals, but I had other teachers. I mean, and what's so interesting is in every step of my career, at least in education, there were the teachers who were the most helpful. Huh. When I was a principal, there were the teachers who were most helpful, not the other principals. Because they would say, yeah, well, I figured it out. You need to figure it out. But there were teachers who said, maybe you want to think about it this way or that way. And as a central office administrator, there were teachers who said, here's some questions you probably should ask that you're not asking. But it was my support structure was always other educators who were as close to where instruction was occurring as possible. And I dare say that's the case now, although many would argue that that the teachers here in Philly don't necessarily have that voice, but I do listen to individuals, and I get hundreds of emails daily from teachers that I then subsequently meet with and talk to that are very helpful to me in my work. But I think the other part is I started in high school, and I started with juniors and seniors in high school, and that's very different than starting in middle school or starting in elementary school with 30 kindergartners and you're just learning how to manage 30 kindergartners. And so it had the benefit that I was with older children who were, and that group of young ladies that I described, very mature, knew what they wanted to do, knew where they wanted to go off to school. I was fortunate, and everyone doesn't have mm-hmm. That good fortune. It's more of what you described, and that was like my student teaching. And it was like, here you go, and it's yours, and then you try something simply because that's what you practiced when you were in college, and it fails miserably. And we don't, in the teaching profession, we are too often and too quick to judge versus to support. And the support could be an individual standing right beside you, just like they did when I was an athlete, and saying, step with this foot instead of the other foot. and that may work for you. And they were there with you every step of the way, and we don't do that. Instead, this goes back to the other point about teachers and the respect thing. I mean, we have created a system where it's quick to evaluate, and it's quick to say this individual is not cutting it. And I talked about the challenges we're having that attracting people to the field. So we have to all get better at making each other better. And you do that through creating environments that coach and support in real time individuals. And I think where I had that help, I was much better than when someone observed me, wrote up something, gave it to me, and said, when I come back in 6 weeks, I want to see you do this. And I had no idea how to do that. And so I do think that is what we have to begin focusing on as an institution. But we're so quick to judge, and we've set up structures now that are judgmental versus supportive. Ooh. And we actually have to get back to this notion of how do we all get better at this?
That was Dr. William Height, superintendent of the Philadelphia School District. And I'm Jamie Jay with Elizabeth Perez-Luna for Common Space. Thank you for listening.